Radio program. We appreciate you taking the time to listen and hopefully learn some new things about the topics that we discuss. I'm Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from the north up in Scandinavia, and it's always an honor to have you with us wherever you're from. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com, that's our websites, and we are continuing our investigation into the conspiracy and the intriguing, strange, sometimes bizarre, and the extraordinary with an open and critical mind. We are asking you to believe nothing but to consider and contemplate. And at the end of the day, what you make of the material that we present, that we leave up to you. We try to offer you a diverse picture with discussions from different sides of the various arguments and topics. And I personally believe it's only with an understanding of the full spectrum that we can begin to make good and coherent choices and form a level of understanding that actually is based on reality and not propaganda or a sensationalized story. We want to know, that's all, and in this process we're forced to sift through a lot of different material to get to the core of the matter. So this is a journey, not an end result. This is the beginning, not the end. Today we are talking to Freeman and Jamie Hanshaw about Hollywood mind control. Freeman is a TV producer, filmmaker, radio talk show host and lecturer that have been with us many times before on the program. He is considered an expert in the fields of the occult, trauma-based mind control, government conspiracy and ancient civilizations. His partner, Jamie Hanshaw, also studies the occult activities of secret societies, the Freemasons, magic, sorcery, Kabbalistic rituals, and Hollywood trauma-based mind control. She, with co-writer Freeman, is compiling all of this information into a fully illustrated, well-referenced compendium of the occult mind pattern programming of Hollywood and the mainstream media in their book Weird Stuff, Operation Culture Creation. We also have Lana from Radio 314 with us during this program, and we have a lot of things to discuss today, so stay with us for much more. 2 hours coming your way. All right, welcome everybody to this Red Ice Radio program. Next to me I have Lana with me here in the studio. Hi Lana, good to have you with us.
Hello.
And on the other side of the pond, somewhere in the United States of America, Freeman and Jamie. Hi Freeman, first to you.
Hi, how are you, Jamie?
Pretty good. Good to talk to you and to Jamie as well. Hi, Jamie.
Hello, Henrik and Lana.
So where are you guys?
We are in Trout Lake, Washington at the East Seti Ranch.
Just hanging out with James Gilliland and checking out the crazy orbs and flying saucers and such.
Right, right. Well, tell us a little bit about what you've seen, if anything. We got asked that.
Well, I gotta say they have treated us like royalty. We have really been enjoying this day big time. And I managed to go out last Saturday and get under the night vision goggles along with the infrared, and looking out at Mount Adams, we had the infrared beaming at the mountain and I had the night vision goggles, and all of a sudden, and now what I had anticipated was just like little orbs showing up inside of the infrared light, and it looked like that. So this to me could have been water vapor or anything showing up in the light beam itself. But of course it's infrared, so you can't see it with the naked eye, but with the night vision you can. So I'm seeing these little orbs, what look like dust particles in the beam itself, and thought, well, you know, whatever that is. And all of a sudden, as I'm thinking that, this massive green orb just comes down from outside of the beam. It wasn't in the light beam at all, and swooped right past, leaving this long trail going right across the whole grounds in front of the mountain, and then just vanished. It was insane. And I was so disappointed, or just like looking around to everyone around me, because I was the only person that could see it. And so it was, you know, it was my experience alone. But amazing.
So what do you think it was?
I have no idea. I have no clue. It blew my mind. I mean, it just, I don't know.
It feels friendly, though. I know Henrik and I saw them. We saw lots of the orbs.
We were there, too, yeah.
Yeah, they speak very highly of you here, by the way.
Thank you. That's very nice. Yeah.
Have you had their famous yak meat spaghetti?
No. But we did see Artemis, who got chased down by a yak. That was just yesterday.
All right, real nice. Jamie, did you get a chance to see anything?
No, I went out last night with the goggles, and I put them on and waited for about 30 minutes. I didn't really see anything, so.
Well, we did see the two UFOs cruising together, and, you know, it's hard to know, but they definitely are too far out to be satellites, and the movement that they were doing was inconsistent. It wasn't just like a straight line. So you did get to see two of those flying together, which made it interesting.
It's got to be a lot of... Well, it feels like it's different phenomena gathered there. One seems to be the orb kind of floating, well, it could be even a few feet in front of you in some cases, or kind of in the green field right there at the foothill of the mountains, while others are way up there in the sky that the guys there kind of shot some lasers at or whatnot. So definitely two different phenomena, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, then I gave a talk here yesterday, very well received. People were blown away, of course. I always have to show my stuff before you can see it. So I did a radio show on James Gilliland, As You Wish, and then the next day I did a talk there, and now today we are here with you. So we're keeping busy.
Definitely understand that. Now we're going to talk a little bit about one of the main topics you guys have been covering for some time now. Basically, Hollywood, the occult propaganda connecting into... to mind control. How long have you been talking about this now, Freeman? And Jamie, you've, of course, kind of added on to this and done excellent additions. We watched some of the stuff beforehand here as well, before we did this. So I'm looking forward to diving into that. But how long have you been doing that kind of work now, Freeman?
Well, you know, I could say that my mother was telling me, you know, Freeman, if you don't stop talking about this weird stuff, you're never going to get a girlfriend. So it's been that long. But now I found the girl writing the book on weird stuff. So, you know, I just wait. So I would say, let's see, publicly I've been discussing this for 7 years. I was, what, I think your fourth interview on Red Ice.
Way back in 2006, yeah.
Yeah, and so I began walking and talking in 93, preaching, you know, spreading the word. And then by 2005 was given the TV show and, you know, started making the inroads of becoming a quote-unquote celebrity. So it's been 7 years of public talking and nearly 20 years of just being me.
So what label do we put on that? Conspiracy evangelist?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
That's good. And Jamie, of course, how long have you been interested in this, Jamie? Did you just first got into this when you hooked up with Freeman or way before that?
No, well, it's interesting because I was raised in a Baptist Christian home, and the Christians have been on the conspiracy trail for as long as I can remember, you know, even back into the early 90s, because they're still waiting for the Armageddon or whatever they're trying to figure out. But my mom would rent, you know, bootleg videos from the Bible bookstore, VCR tapes about FEMA camps and the Clinton Chronicles and black helicopters, and she would bring them home, and I'd watch them as a little kid, and so I kind of always knew that the world wasn't what everyone else thought it was, and so I've been introduced to these things very early, and I kind of... I was a fan of Freeman before I met him. You know, I was listening to David Icke and Michael Tessarian, Jordan Maxwell, anybody, you know, Red Ice that I could find. And then I found Freeman, and he was the only one that I thought it would be fun to actually meet up with. So I went to Austin, and we met, and we had a, you know, we hit it off, and I said, "Do you have a girlfriend?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, you do now."
No choice, Sarah.
So.
But of course, talk to me. You wander around talking about this stuff, and you become a bit ostracized from society.
Yeah.
But that's something that I had to deal with early on, you know, knowing these things as a child, trying to tell people about it. And so I just kind of let go of my ego, and now I don't really care what people say or if they believe me or not, because I've been dealing with it for 20 years or more.
And now, Jamie, how would you say that it's different, I guess, with that background in from Christianity and conspiracy, that kind of angle to it, and what you do today? Is there a new angle or area that wasn't highlighted with that background?
That's interesting, because they were always very much into the cartoons and the movies and the kids' toys. They saw the satanic elements in them. They saw the witchcraft elements in them. You know, I wasn't allowed to watch the Smurfs. I wasn't allowed to watch MTV or VH1 or The Simpsons or Married with Children. So I always kind of knew that there was a dark side to entertainment industry.
And the biggest difference, I think, between now and what the Christians were giving her before is that they don't want to read the books on the occult. Jamie's sitting here reading Thank You, Satan, or what was it, Satan Wants You, and the rituals of the Church of Satan. And these type of topics would be completely ignored and feared by the Christian researchers. They don't want to open those books. So Jamie has taken this, you know, the next level, being able to actually study the occult.
Well, the thing is, they wouldn't recommend that, you know, regular parishioners of the church read these occult books, but it was okay for a pastor or someone high level up mm-hmm. to be studying these things so they could teach you about it. But I just kind of disagreed with that myself and started cracking open these books, and I found something really interesting is that a lot of the topics in magic have to do with Christianity and praying to the archangels. You know, Lord's Prayer is actually the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram from the Kabbalah. So it's really mashed up, and it's hard to separate what is quote-unquote witchcraft from Christianity.
Is there something that is dangerous in reading or going through the content? Because I believe you're right. You hear that just don't analyze it. Don't look at it. Just stay away from it because it's all evil and don't learn anything about it. But, I mean, personally, I believe we should study something to learn about it more, to kind of demystify the subject. But
right.
At the same time, I can understand if you're not careful, you know, it might take you places you don't want to go.
Yeah, but I think that attitude is more dangerous than fearing the information is to fear looking at it, because then you don't really learn the history of astrotheology or where, you know, the star of the Magi. Everything that they're talking about in the Bible is very much expounded upon in the Kabbalah and magic and stuff like that. So I think the Christians are missing out on part of their history by not looking at these things.
Well, I think Christianity have been a part of the whole game plan, if you will, some of the things we're going to examine today. I don't know if you guys agree with that or not, but it feels to me that it's the other side of the same coin, if you will. It's this dichotomy that we've been kind of forced to choose between. Either it's Jesus or Satan, and it's very kind of confined, restricted in a way.
Absolutely. I always felt that way when trying to work with Christian exposés, and the answers they have seem so simple because they always offer, well, you worship Jesus as the answer and Satan is the problem. And so when you're starting to get into what we talk about with high profile rituals, the occult of Hollywood, things of this nature, you can't do it. You know, it's such a simple job as a Christian to go, well, that's witchcraft and that's Satan. And not ever give you the full understanding of what's necessary to realize why this is going on.
Well, you know what's funny to me is, you know, all my friends' parents were very strict, and they weren't allowed to watch rated R movies or anything with, like, kissing or sexual content or anything like that. And it seemed like Disney movies had carte blanche in the household no matter what, because they were, quote-unquote, innocent. And I just always found this very nefarious that you know, the Disney, the cartoons can get in the back door by being innocent, but mm-hmm. they're the worst out there, in my opinion.
But today, the updated Disney movies that they're making, you know, they're flirting and there's a lot of sexual innuendos in them.
Definitely. There's a movie called Planet 51 about this little boy who goes to a planet just like ours, but it's aliens. And he's the alien on that planet. And if you watch that with those sexual innuendos in mind, you'll see a ton of them. I couldn't believe it. I was scandalized watching this kid's movie like I am usually, because I'm a big kid at heart, really, and I love kid stuff. I love toys and cartoons. I've worked with kids my whole life. I've taught Sunday school. I've kids choir, you know, work with at-risk youth and stuff like that. And so I'm surrounded by toys and cartoons all the time. And now that I have these keys, you know, the trauma-based mind control and the sexual innuendos and stuff, it's almost everything I watch, I'm traumatized by it.
Now, it seems like Hollywood and, well, all the entertainment industry has gone through a major transformation. There might be an element of, well, how should I put it, being very innocent in the beginning, although there might be hidden occult things behind the scenes that are, you know, speaking to the subconscious that are very nefarious, and we can certainly talk about that. But it feels like the whole entertainment industry has gone through a major transformation, and I know that you guys talk about this too. Today it's very much identifying with the darkness, with the other side of the coin, right?
No doubt about that. And it's funny because a lot of people want to point out the subliminal things inside of Disney or these other films. We tend to highlight Disney because they're just rampant with it, but they want to find these little hidden things, like you know, the 26th frame or something like this, where they're finding something hidden within it, or sex shows up in the tangled hair in the film Tangled and the poster. And to us, this is the tame side of it. This is the, you know, this is just for marketing, just to make it attached to your brain. But when you just take the storyline, just the open storyline, you find the true purpose of the making of this propaganda. So perhaps we should, you know, discuss a little bit about how Walt Disney is propaganda, and then we could understand how this has actually unfolded, because it's not the hidden stuff at all. It is the straightforward storyline in this picture. So let's stick with Tangled for a second and just analyze the storyline. So what we have is this girl who is rebelling against her mother. Her mother's just trying to take care of her and save her from villainous people like this thief that she's fallen in love with.
But all along, I mean, the backstory is her mother's an evil witch. And that's something that I've been tracking, is this what they're doing to femininity in general, and to motherhood and to sisterhood. And I've noticed that all the princesses, what they have in common is they don't have a mother, or their mother is an evil witch, and they don't have any girlfriends or sisters that are actual true sisters, right? So the only friends they have are animals to relate to. And this was interesting because, you know, we go around and we go from town to town and we go to all the used bookstores. And sometimes we find some gems. And I found this one by Anton LaVey, you know, the founder of the Church of Satan in 1966. And he wrote a book just for women. And I found what he said so interesting, as far as what does it mean to be a satanic witch, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to read you some excerpts from his book. It says, a satanic witch always makes full use of her feminine wiles. In order to be a successful witch, one does have to make a pact with the devil, at least symbolically. She must worship the Luciferian element of pride within her. So what we're talking about here is like princess programming. You know, you walk down the aisles of your Walmart or your Target, whatever, you know, giant superstore you happen to be at, and the girls' aisles are all pink. And it's all pink princess, tutus, cooking sets, high heels. I've even seen fluffy handcuffs.
That's right.
For little right? And if you go down the boys' aisle, it's all blue, Transformers, Star Wars, and cars. And cars is an interesting thing for boys, and we can get back to that. But I just wanted to keep talking about how Anton LaVey described a satanic witch. It says, if you have good looks and want to be a witch, you must exploit your beauty at every opportunity. And this all goes along, you can say, you know, the princess programming, right? It says, a witch can never get too much attention. Your first duty as a witch is to your appearance. And actually, the title of this chapter is called Bitchcraft. It's funny because I was writing an article for my book called Project Crazy Bitch. And my theory is that they are trying to make women mentally unstable. And you can see this kind of with the color pink that they're pushing. You know, Victoria's Secret has this whole pink line of clothes, and you see pink everywhere, pink for girls, pink, pink, pink. Anton LaVey says the color pink is always sure to work magic as it is the color of feminine intimacy. And in another occult book, I read that they can use pink as a color of emotional instability. So this is kind of what we're seeing in women a lot, is the emotional instability, because they're trying to follow this fairy tale that's been laid out for them. I mean, how many times have you seen Disney themes in weddings? Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is like there, but in America, the wedding is a big, big deal. You know, have you ever seen Bridezillas?
Bridezillas? No. Have you, Lona?
Unfortunately, I have seen the advertisements for that.
So, you know, this girl's engaged and they do a different one every time, but she just turns into a raging bitch. Like the of getting married. And
the wedding is the pinnacle in a woman's life. It's, you know, the most important day of her life. It's not even about the guy, really. It's just about the ceremony and the appearance of it.
Yeah, and so for them, there's nothing after that. And they've kind of been molding their lives around this fairy tale. And once you get married, it's like the curtain's drawn and what's next. And so it kind of forms, you know, a schism in the brain where they feel like there's nothing left for them.
Wow. And so this is the marketing of the ritual of wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no doubt.
Wow. So what is the, maybe we can just analyze a few of these kind of components here that you've talked about. There is a, must be some kind of message in the, in No Mother, as you mentioned before, and also maybe we can talk a little bit more about this princess programming that you call it, Jamie.
Okay. Well, what I was talking about before, you know, is like the girls don't have any sister friends, right? And in the book The Satanic Witch, it says one of the sure signs of potential proficiency in witchcraft is an inability to get along with other women.
Hmm.
It says to be a resourceful witch, you must be able to see the bitchiness in other women for exactly what it is. Then in your own way, beat them at their own game. You must learn to be a worse bitch than they.
Wow.
It's what you as a witch accumulate in the way of lust power, and that's the princess programming, right, the worshipping. It says what you as a witch accumulate in the way of lust power from others will in turn give you greater magnetic power over others. A chapter called Fashion, the Witch's Greatest Friend, he explains that the only footwear that a witch should be wearing is a 3-inch heel. So he says your default look, well, if you're trying to enchant someone, you have to kind of tailor your look around what you think would be enchanting to this person that you're trying to cast a spell on or whatever you want from them. But your default look should be something like Samantha from Bewitched, you know, the old 60s with the nice dress and the hair done and the skirt and the stockings and the 3-inch heel. And it's funny because he says that you know, 2-inch heels are not going to work, and 4-inch heels aren't going to work. It has to be this specific 3-inch heel, because that gives you the right curvature of your, you know, your derriere and your thighs and your calves and everything. But that makes me think immediately of that show Sex and the City from HBO. Have you seen that?
I've stayed away from it, but unfortunately, I know what it is. Yeah,
I have, and it's getting women just to be obsessed with materialism and body worship, and that's all it is to be feminine, is to have designer clothes and have a guy think that you're hot, and that's where it ends. You know.
because you're trying to enchant them. But one of the reoccurring themes in this show is that they all wear Manolo Blahnik high heels, you know, the 3-inch heels, and she won't be caught dead without these 3-inch heels. And even in one episode, she goes into her kitchen and opens up her oven, and it's full of shoes. You know, nothing in her kitchen is nurturing or nutritious or motherly or feminine. It's all shoes.
Well, that's very interesting. I know you guys talked about this, and maybe we can discuss a little bit more. This is about destruction of the feminine, the separating the woman from the earth, of grounding, literally. What is that all about?
Well, in my opinion, the Trinity is kind of, you know, the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Trinity. I interpret the Holy Spirit aspect of it to be the feminine aspect, because what else would it be? You're not going to have a baby. You know, you can't have Father and Son without Mother. So Mother is actually the Holy Spirit, and the Earth is the Mother, and that's, you know, the Sophia or the Gaia or whatever you want to call it. It's the So they're actually blaspheming the Holy Spirit every time they kill the mother, every time they torture. You know, it's like you can't watch a movie without them killing or torturing the mother, if she's even in the movie.
Now, politically, this comes out in Hebrew, the Holy Spirit is known as the Shekinah, and it is the feminine version of God within Hebrew mysticism. So when we look to things like when they make a play upon the Shekinah, and they blew up Baghdad using the Shekinah, which is Shekinah, that was another display of this destruction of the mother.
Hmm. Now, who are the writers to these kinds of things? We got to get into this as well. And I can't help to tie it back to the destruction of the feminine. These are men that are transforming, in my opinion, the what it means to be a woman, femininity. What do you think about that, guys?
Walt Disney had a very low opinion of women. They were not allowed to do any of the cartooning. They were only allowed to be colorers, and they were shacked off in a room all alone and worked slave hours. So whenever you were a woman trying to work for Walt Disney, you were absolutely put in your place, according to him.
There are no women animators at the beginning. They were, yeah, like you said, locked in the basement, painting cells day in and day out, and they had to ask permission to go to the bathroom. You know, they had a very rigid schedule and a very slavish job. I mean, it sounds fun to color cartoons, but once you're doing thousands of palettes a day, it turns into slavery, basically.
Hmm.
So these are men that hate women, basically.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the main artists of Disney were known as the Nine Old Men, and of course this to the Ennead of the ancient Egyptian gods and the Nine.
Yeah.
But when you start to look into Disney, if we just want to throw this out there, because Disney on the Front Lines is their war propaganda film. I tell everyone to go get this. You can probably check it out of your library. Disney on the Front Lines. And it's all of their war propaganda cartoons. And in this very film, they boast that Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propagandist, adopted Walt Disney's techniques of using cartoons to program the Nazi youth. Now, Disney put out a film called Education for Death, and this was how to make a Nazi. And they show you how this little boy won't kill. And so, of course, they put a dunce cap on him and laugh at him because he wouldn't kill until they finally made him into a killer, and then he was accepted by the rest of the group.
But the interesting thing about that little cartoon is if you watch it, the story of this little Nazi youth, when he falls ill and his mother is caring for him, the stormtrooper comes to the door, knock, 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 and he tells him in German, you better not coddle that boy or you're going to make him soft. So this is kind of, and it's interesting too because the Nazi party, I hate to say this, but has a lot of roots in homosexuality. And I'm not, you know, say anything about homosexuals. I'm just telling you that this is the truth. And if you read this book called The Pink Swastika, it'll tell you all about it.
Right, yeah.
But basically, they hate anything feminine, even effeminate gays. So that's when they said the Nazis would persecute the gays is they were actually just persecuting the effeminate gays, but the butch gays they would keep because they were better killers.
So there's no feminine at all in the picture here. I mean, again, I go back to Sex and the City, right? And the writers is something that's continuing to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're homosexual writers, and also the fashion designers. Most of them are gay men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gay men telling women how to be women. That's interesting, right?
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, but now they're replacing them with transgender models, replacing women. I mean, I've seen ads where they're males actually modeling bras.
Yeah, we were just walking through Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and they had this big exhibit for Jean-Paul Gaultier, the fashion designer.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And his main character on the poster board was a woman with, it looks like she had the rays of the Statue of Liberty coming out of her head. And then her face was covered in lace, and her mouth was totally covered, and there was a chain link around her head, you know, like a chain.
It's like bounding Lady Liberty as his promotion.
Wow.
So what do they benefit from by you know, binding femininity or holding femininity back?
Well, I just think they're trying to put everything out of balance. You know, that's what, you know, black magic is making everything in disharmony. And when you have the feminine squashed and you have the masculine on top, that's disharmony. And then if you have the feminine on top and the masculine demasculated, then that's out of whack too. So anything that can be extreme, that's what they're going for, I think.
And it keeps everybody seeking their position, their gender position. And so as we were saying with the Princess Warrior programming, when you're walking down your store aisles, you've got all the bubblegum cell phones and the bling and all of these things for the little girls. And then the boys have nothing but war, you know, and even Ultimate Fighting Champion. I saw a UFC toy at Walmart. That blew my mind. But once you've got everybody in this disharmony and they're trying to seek this harmony, the Princess Warrior programming causes the male to go and be a fighter, be in the war program, the military-industrial complex, in order to afford the bubblegum cell phones for the girls.
It was the diamonds, right, Marilyn Monroe, the marketing of that to the men, and this is what you have to go get to get the girl kind of thing. So there's no nurturing mothers in the archetypal stories that Disney is putting out that we're talking about. They're turning little girls into, well, I don't know, they're being manipulated, of course, but in the process they're being turned into sexual predators, I guess, and they're confusing the gender roles and everything is happening. So there's, is this a part of that kind of the craziness that you talked about before, Jamie, to make girls kind of crazy?
Yes, and I think the princess programming is only the first step, because once you get past that, then you're onto vampires. You know, when you're a tween, you go to Twilight and the supernatural, you know, like things like Katy Perry, E.T., and these dark, dark coupling with fallen angels, basically. You can't call it anything else but that. And so once you convince a girl that she's a princess, right, she's royalty, well, we know what royalty really is. You know, they're connected to the Alpha Draconians or however you want to put that, the lizard people and blood drinking. So the next step from princess is vampire. And I've even taken pictures of T-shirts that say, forget being a princess, I'd rather be a vampire.
And we thought that this might open them up, because maybe there is going to be a revelation here where we do actually find David Icke to be right, or that these people are vampires, or that there is a deeper story in here. I mean, of course, we got Queen Mary and her blood baths. We've got Lady Gaga and her blood bath recently at that hotel with the Masons. And we wonder, because they basically show you, well, here's Edward Cullen, you know, and women are leaving their husbands because they don't live up to his standards. And then we wonder if, you know, when people finally get to royalty and they finally get to get to these people, we find out that they're not actually really vampires. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is to me, again, we go back to that idea of it's about identifying with the darkness. I know, Freeman, you and I talked about that many years ago now, how the movies, the music industry is turning towards this identification of the dark side or the shadow persona that many people have. And it's like a desire, an unconscious desire in that that people are drawn to. And they're playing on this at the same time, those who know how to pull the strings, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because there's this show on HBO called True Blood. Have you heard of that one?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a show about vampires, and the premise of the show is that they've created this synthetic blood called True Blood, and the vampires want to come out of the closet and live amongst the humans and as equals because, you know, humans don't have to fear them anymore because we've created this True Blood. If you keep watching the show, it's really interesting the politics of trying to, what they call, mainstream evil into the world. And now, if you get into the later seasons, they're worshiping Lilith and they're drinking her blood, and there's different factions of vampires, ones that want to stay hidden and worship Lilith and actually feed on people in the dark, and then there's the ones that want to come out and cohabitate and, you know, be reformed and drink the true blood. So this, what I think is, like, politics is fake and movies are real.
But currently, if you think about it, the quality of souls that's coming in right now is not so good. There's a lot of psychic vampires, so I think that they get off on this kind of stuff. It activates them. It's like a home frequency when they watch that. It's like, yeah, that's me. You know, I need to go eat some food, energy food. Okay. You know what I mean?
You can buy bags of blood at your movie stores these days to drink.
Any blood.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's corn syrup. Used for infusions, it says on the label. Yeah, you know, and for me, I've been tracking this, what I found to be the Clefot, or the fallen angels. And this began right in the beginning of my studies of deciphering corporate logos and coming to the number 66. Now, as I went through each corporate logo, you know, the pentagram of Walmart or the Target, sun sign of Target, and I got the Phillips 66, and I was like, well, this shouldn't be too hard to decipher. Everything else, every corporate logo I ever deciphered fits into the Masonic ritual and therefore into the Kabbalah. And so I simply went to a Kabbalistic dictionary and looked up the number 66 to figure out what Phillips 66 gas station was all about. And of course, there was also Highway 66. And I came to this revelation of the Clefot is what they're called in Kabbalah, or the fallen angels. It's Azrael, it's Lilith, it's Samael, and they're all listed there as the fallen angels. So I began this theme of following the 66, and it became so consistent that I knew I was onto something. Because even if we bring it up to the modern day, now I track this, now 6 in Hebrew is V, and we've covered this on the show before, so we'll just go through fast. In Hebrew, the letter 6 is V, so when you look at Hitler's Volkswagen, you'll see 2 Vs interlaced. That's the 66, the letter of the fallen angels. But lacing them together, making a third V, makes it 666. As I started to look into this, it appeared that this was the sign for the other dimension, because there is a tree of life in the Kabbalah that has 10 sephirah, or ciphers, on it. And in order to go to heaven, straight from the base, you have to go through what is known as Da'at, or the abyss. And in the abyss, this is the area of the Clefot, or the fallen angels, or Coronazon, or Leviathan, any of these type of demonic things that you want to look into are all in the abyss. And you have to cross this. Now, the path that you take across from Malkuth, which is earth, to Kether, which is heaven, is the G. It is the G path on the tree of life. And so this would explain the Masonic G inside of the compass and square. You have to go across the abyss. Aleister Crowley tried this and failed miserably. Anyone that says you dabble in this and you become insane. Well, so I started tracking this very symbolism, and you go to Fringe, the new TV show, the sci-fi, well, it's not that new anymore, but they have an alternate dimension, and it is labeled by FF. Well, guess what? F is 6 in English. So FF, again, is the 66. So I followed this a little further down the path, and I found, so we have Madonna at the Super Bowl. She stands up on a stage and immediately has giant VV under her feet, and you can see this on FreemanTV.com, under Hollywood Mind Control. She is there with standing on a VV, and the VV makes an OX out of the two crossed V's. And when I looked up OX, which of course is 66 again in English because O is the 15th letter and X is the 24th letter, 1 and 5, 6, 2 and 4, 6, right? So OX, when I looked into Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God written by Kenneth Grant, one of his accolades in the Ordo Templi Orientis, he says that the OX is actually the mark of the beast. Well, then I look over at X-Men and I see the beast. The character, and he has, of course, that OX on his chest, as all the X-Men do. And, of course, Disney owns Marvel, all right? So let's just keep that square, too. So this 66 has been a consistent theme that I've followed, and now I have even brought this to CERN and mind transfer technologies of punching holes into the other dimension and transmitting your soul into it. I have a new article coming out on this in Paranoia Magazine. Just came out in this edition, so I highly recommend it. I cover the space war and its connections to this alternate dimension and how this 66 and the FX and the OX and all of that fits into this. Well, so here's Madonna on the stage at Super Bowl with all of that symbol repeated over and over again. And then I'm watching the Olympics, and of course we're dealing with Voldemort battling Mary Poppins. But as they start the Olympics, they have a countdown, and they show all the balloons. There's a batch of balloons for 9 and a batch of balloons for 8, and they all explode. When they got to 6, every balloon exploded except for 2 sixes, leaving them on the screen. So even in the Olympics, I found this very same symbolism of the fallen angels.
I agree. Would you want to say something on that, Jimmy?
Well, if there's another movie by Disney that is being pushed really hard, and some movies are really pushed and some movies are you know, swept under the rug, like the nice ones, like Marzi's Mom, that is just ignored. But the one that they're really pushing hard now is called Cars. Have you seen that one?
No.
Well, Cars is a little story about a race car traveling down Route 66, and he gets in trouble and has to, basically the story is about him having to do his time and be processed through the criminal court system.
And he becomes a prison slave, really. He has to do all the work and everything. It's a prison workforce that they're implanting in the children, along with subservience to the system. So one thing that we see is as we go through the different store aisles, we'll see which ones are really highlighted, like Clone Wars, Clone Victory. These are very common things that you will see inside of, and if you do see a Star Wars character, you know, they'll have a lightsaber or some type of warfare going on. But the other main one that we saw all the time in everything was Cars. And so we're like, all right, why are they pushing Cars? Well, it shows subservience to the court systems and political prisoners or, prison workforce.
If you go to Disneyland right now, their new grand opening section of their theme park is all dedicated to Cars, the movie Cars. So they've an entire, Cars playland that you can go and dissociate in.
Oh, nice. Now, Kabbalism, occult Kabbalism, I don't know if there are two different factions or if it's just the one. Is it, what would you say to that, Freeman? Is it Freemasonic? Is it Judaic? Is it something else?
The Kabbalah?
Yeah.
Well, the story of the Kabbalah is goes back to Moses of going up to the mount and receiving the Ten Commandments in the Ark of the Covenant. And it was said that he went up 3 times receiving the law, and then he received the spirit of the law, and then he received the soul of the law. And so it was in that was the Kabbalah, and he brought this back to the people. So that's the history of how Kabbalah came up. But what I've realized was, as I was reading Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike, and over 70 times he mentions the Kabbalah. And so then I realized that the Kabbalah and Freemasonry are the same.
Because this seems to be, well, many of the things in numerology and everything else has an imprint, and it seems to go back to do the Kabbalah or Kabbalism or the numerology aspect as well. And so, And again, we're back to that idea. What side of the coin is this? Is it Luciferianism? Is it God or Yahweh? Or is it, I mean, I always have a feeling that they're very similar, these entities. And either you pray to one side of the coin or the other. There's not much option or room here.
Yeah, that is the big question, isn't it? You know, and that goes back to what we were talking about with Christianity avoiding these studies, because can magic be used for good? And could these Kabbalistic beliefs bring us understanding that lead us beyond? I mean, people like Madonna obviously believe so.
Esther, right?
Oh, yeah, and going off and doing rituals at the cemetery with the rabbis in Israel. She's even changed her name down to Kabbalah, too, with Madonna removing all of the vowels and making it MDNA, which I found very curious because I'm starting to get into the clones and drones story and getting into cloning of humanity. And we find that Madonna has a DNA sweep team.
Yeah,
that is
that's right.
All of arena masters, because she has to bring in her whole DNA cleanup team to remove any parts of her DNA that might have been left behind.
People call her crazy, yeah. But I think she knows something. She knows what could be done potentially with those small little traces left behind.
Yeah, because currently on the International Space Station right now are 6 adult stem cells seeking longevity for humanity. We got this along with the Archon's Genome Project. I don't know if you know about this coming out in.
For sure. The Archon X Prize and the genomics contest, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, in the history of the Archons wanting to disturb our DNA from the Nag Hammadi text, and, you know, but they can't do it themselves. They have convinced us to do it. So, here, let's offer them some of these pantacles we call money, and they'll get them to do it for us. I don't know. That one blew my mind when I'm going through all of this stuff.
Now, the 66 is interesting. I mean, that even goes back to the Clone Wars that you mentioned before. It seems to be another kind of, well, I guess, code in there. And, I couldn't help to agree with you when you talked about the Olympics as well. And again, I saw in the Olympics, I mean, it's a vast subject. We need a whole show to microanalyze that alone. But no doubt, there's a very, very dark message. It's about satanic. It's about the devil. Look at the poems that were read, the association. Even the building of Zion was this kind of mechanical industrial city with XXX written on the pipes, the chimneys. It was the XXX Olympiad 666. Very dark stuff. And the nightmares of the children and the bedtime stories. What is that all about? Why is this association again with the darkness so prominent in these times? Do either of you have an idea about that?
Well, I kind of wish I had made a list of what we would expect to see in the Olympic opening ceremonies, because, you know, a dark sorcerer, a dark reptilian sorcerer, the death of babies. The only thing I didn't really see was the Scarlet Woman or a blood sacrifice. But when we have this whole story now, Mary Poppins popping into this story, John Dee in 007 with the Queen, of course. But Mary Poppins to me was pretty intriguing because Jamie had done such a deep investigation of Mary Poppins. It's one of her favorite movies. And, you know, we always have to flip things back and forth because obviously it's got something in there they want us to key in on.
Well, I have to say that I love Mary Poppins. That is my ultimate favorite movie, and it is a Disney movie, so that's interesting too. But I just find it so rich in symbolism of the kind of magic that I'm trying to put out there, which is called slack magic. And if you watch, there's one scene where she tells you something very esoteric and valuable, and it's in a song called A Spoonful of Sugar. Have you heard that song?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's telling you that if you view the world as a child does, and everything that you do is play, then nothing is going to ever be hard work because you're just playing a game at it. And this is something I've heard from, you know, Ascended Masters. I've heard it from Ramtha. I've heard it from Abraham, Esther Hicks and the Challenge of Abraham. I keep hearing this over and over. If you're playing, it's not working. And that song really embodies that philosophy. And then there's other things, you know, about laughter and family, and she actually brings the family back together. And then, you know, the dad is a very stiff upper lip British, everything has to be right on time, like clockwork, you know. And she comes in and shows him that, you know, that's not the way. And I just love the the moral about where the little boy takes his allowance to feed the birds instead of depositing it in the bank where he can, you know, be part of railways through India and all other sorts of exploitations that they're trying to get him to deposit his money in. But he says, no, I want to feed the birds. So he actually makes the bank crash because he starts a run on the bank when he runs out with his money, and everyone's like, they won't give someone their money. So everyone takes their money out. He crashes the bank. Dad loses his job. But in the end, it's okay because, you know, they still find laughter. And the family is reunited. So I really like Mary Poppins. I was surprised to see it, but I thought that was the perfect counterpoint to Voldemort.
Mm. Yeah. Now, another theme in this is about, it's about the destruction of the family in a lot of the movies. Again, just the fact that a mother is usually missing, and it's, I mean, not that it's wrong to have animals as friends, but that's the Disney theme anyway. It's always that. And it's nothing about the family unit and that as a core. This is about disassociating that and, well, creating, as you said, Freeman, as well, either the soldier or the warrior or the mind control princess. So it's just interesting to see the Mary Poppins theme come up in that scenario then. Does it, was anything taken away from it, or did you see that they were trying to destroy the message of Mary Poppins in the opening ceremony, Jamie? Any comments on that?
Not really at all. I was really shocked to see that, because that would be my answer to, you know, defeating the dark side is Mary Poppins and black magic. But it's interesting, in that movie there's a strong female character, the mother. She's actually a suffragette for women's rights in the show, but then when her husband comes home, she hides all the paraphernalia and doesn't talk about it. But at the end, it all comes back together, and they're a family unit flying a kite in the park together, so...
And speaking on that family unit, the movie Mars Needs Moms. Now, we're friends with Dan Fogler, who is the star in that. And actually, I will be in his new film, Don Peyote. Should be coming out anytime, sometime soon, between now and December. So be on the lookout for Don Peyote. This is Dan Fogler's awakening film. What he did is he took all the money Disney paid him, and he made his own awakening film. And he went around and interviewed and filmed and played the character Warren Allman to go around and find the answers. And I did play a fairly major role in the film, but they had to cut most of my scenes because we filmed it in the Mason Lodge, and they wouldn't allow them to use the footage. So actually, my parts are going to come out more. I'm in the film, but my real parts will come out more when the documentary of Don Peyote comes out. So be on the look for Don Peyote. But the thing was, we were sitting around talking with Dan Fogler while he was filming Mars Needs Moms, and we started telling him about, you know, the death of the mother and all of these things, and he's like, oh, well, I'm in a Disney film. And we're like, yeah, which one? And he's like, Mars Needs Moms. And we're laughing because, you know, we didn't know that, and we were just telling him about the death of the mother and everything. You know, in that film, it shows you that if you're a really good child and your mother takes very good care of you, she'll get abducted by aliens and be killed. So that's kind of the opening moral of the story. But what happens in the end is that these Martians discover that they weren't separate beings. You see, they kept the men and women separated in the film the whole time.
Well, actually, they threw the babies in the the boy babies in the trash.
Yeah, the boy babies would go down in a trash. Shoot, and the girls would remain as the militant forces, and they were all controlled by robots that were programmed by the mothers they abducted from Earth. Well, in the end, they find this family unit of a painting on the wall in a cave showing them all together as a family unit, and this brings the whole society back together.
So they actually find the Holy Trinity, you know, mom, dad, and baby painted on the wall, and they take that back.
And this breaks the power of the militant overlord, which is also a woman.
Who looks like a man.
Yeah.
Like an ant.
Yeah.
Like a fascist man.
Yeah. But what happened was they yanked Mars Needs Moms out of the theater before it ever had a full run. And Fogler really thought that was a conspiracy of its own because it was too positive. And they actually yanked Mars Needs Moms long before it needed to be yanked.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to Mary Poppins for a second, because for me, when I look at her, she was kind of creeping me out, actually, Jamie. I look at her like I look at Batman. You don't know if he's good or if he's bad. You know, she's smiling, but you're like, wearing black. I kind of took it during the Olympic ceremony. All the kids, you know, they're sick, basically, and then she shows up, and it's like, oh, a little bit of sugar makes the poison go down. You know what I mean? It's like, take some more pills or eat this food with all the sugar, and it's kind of killing you, and it's going to make you sick, and you're going to have problems.
That's another take on it. Yeah,
that is definitely one way of looking at it. And it's interesting that Mary Poppins is a witch, right? She has magical powers. She floats around in an umbrella. She can levitate. You know, she wears black, like you said. All these things that you would associate with witchcraft. So it is true that. And then there's the umbrella again, which is a classic symbol of trauma-based mind control. So there is that.
There was another thing I wanted to bring up again. Again, I mean, a whole show could be done, obviously, about the Olympics, and it should be done. One of the things were the, because you mentioned the fallen angels before, I want to tie back to that, the pandemonium portion of the Olympics opening ceremony. Boyle described a section of the ceremony as pandemonium in reference to the capital of hell in Paradise Lost. And even the actor there, Kenneth Branagh, I think he read a passage during that scene as well, or maybe it was slightly before. But again, just to reemphasize that, pandemonium is the capital of hell in the epic poem Paradise Lost by the 17th century English poet John Milton. It goes on here to say that pandemonium basically means all or every, one portion of it, and the other meaning is little spirit or little angel. And a Christian interpretation of this means little demon, or just a demon. So it is the name invented by John Milton for the capital of hell. It is the high capital of Satan and his peers, built by these little demons, or actually the fallen angels, at the suggestion of Mammon at the end of Book 1 in Paradise Lost. And that's written in 1667. So we have the 66 and close to 1666 when London burnt down and all that as well. But what is this fallen angel theme? Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that and elaborate on this. Is this what they're trying to bring to Earth? Freeman, you mentioned CERN before. Are they trying to invoke these fallen angels and bring them back? How should we interpret this, do you think?
The first time that we're introduced to these fallen angels in the Bible, in the King James Bible, is they are lusting after Earth women, right? So they just find Earth women so beautiful that they can't control themselves, so they have to go and mix with them. And, of course, this creates the Nephilim, or, you know, the giants. And the Earth women couldn't even bear the babies because they were too big, and they would come out eating their mother. You know, they would just, like, claw their way out, according to the Book of Enoch and stuff like that. And that fits exactly parallel with the Twilight series. Have you seen these movies?
I've seen one, I think, of that. I don't even remember.
They
it
were
was so
horrible.
Bad. So
they
bad.
Were so bad. We didn't even finish watching it, actually.
Really bad, yeah. But the fourth one, actually, she does get pregnant while she's still a human by her vampire husband, and he has to tear the baby out with his teeth because she can't bear the pregnancy, and she actually has to start drinking blood and doing all these things to keep herself alive because she has a demon child inside her. And so this is what tweens are reading.
Twilight language, the Twilight Zone, you know?
Yeah, well, and there's a thing called the Twilight Language. If you look that up, a lot of people have written about how the dark occultists use this thing called the Twilight Language. So that's another tie-in with that.
Well, we are going to be on our way from here after we visit Yelm. As you know, we are traveling around in our mystery school mobile media lab, Miss Emily, our school bus. We've been on the road for 10 months now, almost a year.
Oh, wow.
Trying to I hope we can talk about this in the second hour, showing the friendship agenda and how people don't need to fear a collapse. That's our real ambition in showing what we're doing. But we can get into that later. So on our travels, we are going to go visit Rex Diabolus Church, who was a member or one of the high priests of the Church of Satan. And I have interviewed him before. He's on my podcast on Freeman TV. And I'm really excited to get to talk to him again, because it's going to tie into CERN and all of these different things. Rex Diabolo's church has now left the Church of Satan, finding them not satanic enough for him. And religion now called the Chaos Imperium. And he is building what he calls the Ragnarok engine. And this is a device to open a portal for the old ones to enter. And it's very similar looking to the Hellboy type scenario that he has going on in the movie. So here we're going to find out if Rex is actually going to, he's turning this thing on December 21st, 2012. And it is his hope that the old ones will actually come out and destroy the New World Order.
Oh, really? That's a different take on that.
Isn't it? That's why to really dig and pick his brain on this. So that ties into the whole CERN idea and what's going on, and we can get deeper into that in the second hour.
All right, let's do that, guys. Let's take a short little break here between the segments. We'll carry on with more in a bit, so stay with us.